Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do Middle Eastern Americans enjoy the same social status as European Americans? Even before 9/11, there was clear evidence that Americans of Arab or Persian descent are sometimes treated as second-class citizens, portrayed negatively in the media, subjected to greater-than-average scrutiny at security checkpoints, even kept off airplanes based on little more than discomfort reported by flight crews. Yet when they fill out a census form, they are instructed to report themselves as white. That makes it tough to track certain kinds of discrimination, and it means Middle Eastern Americans don't qualify for any minority protections or count in any diversity initiatives. So what might change if Middle Eastern Americans were not classified as white? John Duranian is a professor of law at Chapman University. He writes about the issue in his new book, Whitewashed, America's Invisible Middle Eastern Minority. John, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You call the concept of Middle Eastern whiteness a bizarre racial fiction. How did it come about?
Well, it's a long story, and my book sort of delves into the issue, looking at how the very notion of whiteness came about as sort of a construct. And one of the arguments I make in my book is that race, as we understand it, is very much a social construct, and it's a concept that changes over time and over space. And so the very notion of whiteness began really as something limited only to individuals of Anglo-Saxon descent. And then gradually over time, as our country was introduced to new immigrant waves from Germany and Ireland, groups that were previously not considered white, like the Irish, like the Italians, like the Greeks, became white. And sort of at the tail end of that movement, you had Middle Eastern Americans petitioning to be declared white by law, actually, in a series of early cases around the turn of last century.
Yeah, and initially that status was very much open for debate.
Exactly. Yeah, and your listeners are probably wondering, well, why does it matter? Why would it matter? Well, this is a fact that under U.S. law until 1952. In order to become a naturalized U.S. citizen, you had to either be white or black by law, nothing in between. So effectively, you had a series of immigrant groups petitioning the government to be declared white by law so that they could receive the benefits of citizenship, which not only meant the right to vote, but also economic rights, like the right to purchase land in many states, or the right to practice law, or to get a fishing license even.
So what expectations of assimilation came tied to that white status that was ultimately granted to Middle Easterners?
Well, it was sort of a quid pro quo. In part, it was the whiteness was granted to groups if they proved sort of their assimilatory worth in society. And sort of groups at the fringes of whiteness, like Middle Easterners, basically in the court cases, needed to prove their conformance to mainstream American values. And sort of one of the interesting things I see when I analyze these old cases that shows how much of a construct this notion of whiteness was race had nothing to do with any kind of inherent biology or certainly genetics. After all, we didn't have DNA tests back then. Rather, what it came down to oftentimes was performance of whiteness. So in other words, people were brought into court, and the question that was asked of someone who was maybe white, maybe not, was how well did you perform whiteness? In other words, did you hang out with people that we know to be white? Did you marry people that we know to be white? Were you wealthy? Did you speak English well? Were you educated? And also importantly, were you Christian? So again, all these sort of traits that aren't necessarily tied to race, but which became associated with whiteness, as in, you know, wealth, education, and Christianity.
We should step back here for a minute and do some defining. When you say Middle Eastern Americans, who are you including?
That's a great question, and frankly, it's one which is riddled with ambiguity itself. I mean, the term Middle East didn't really emerge until the early part of the 20th century, and it was really a geopolitical term. It was developed by an admiral, Mahan, who wrote a book about naval power. And he was very famous in terms of influencing both American foreign policy as well as, general military policy in the world. And it generally is said to refer to the area that was previously known, oddly enough, as West Asia, or is also known now as the Near East. So really, we're talking about the area of land that includes, Saudi, modern Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Israel, Lebanon, and then in some definitions, Iran also, but in some definitions it extends as far east, or rather west, as North Africa, and as far east as possibly Afghanistan and even Pakistan.
John Turanian is my guest. He's a professor of law at Chapman University. His new book is called Whitewashed, America's Invisible Middle Eastern Minority. So what it means today that people who are of Middle Eastern heritage check off the white box on the census is that essentially there are no protections against discrimination, no benefits from things like women and minority-owned contracting.
Well, no, there are certainly protections. I mean, even if you are white, you cannot be discriminated against at law. It becomes somewhat more of a challenge, I say, for Middle Eastern Americans because they're sort of in this situation where they're defined as white by law because, as a matter of law, they must check the white box. If people look at sort of the white box the next time they're staring at a census form or something like that, you'll see that it says individuals of European descent, Middle Eastern descent, and even North African descent. And one of the big disconnects is how, what the law says and what people perceive. And one of the arguments I make in my book is that the perceptions of whiteness of Middle Easterners has grown dramatically less over time. In other words, while in the early part of the 20th century they were they fought for their whiteness effectively, like many other immigrant groups, over time they become perceived of as less white, and that's been largely a function of geopolitics, of the fact that since the 1970s. Or even before, but really in sort of the American imagination. Since the 1970s, there have been a series of crises in the Middle East, and we've become familiar with things like Islamic terrorism, something that, wasn't, on the radar back in the early 20th century. And so the sense is that Middle Easterners have become more and more part of the other. They're seen as different than us. And so what happens is there's this disconnect between their classification as white and the law, which basically says they don't get any of the benefits then of minority groups, certainly not affirmative action or any policies like that, yet they face much of the discrimination that a traditional minority group would face. And in fact, if one thinks about it, especially post 9/11, they're facing much more discrimination than they were before. And one of the arguments I make is that civil rights movement has done a very good job in terms of elevating the rights of many Americans. But one thing it hasn't done is focus on Middle Eastern Americans. And if anything, over time, Middle Eastern Americans have actually seen more discrimination rather than less discrimination.
It's very interesting that you cover this in the book. This is something that you struggle with. If, in fact, we decide that we ought to add another box to the census, and it's not just about that, on the one hand, this really validates the idea of race as a thing as opposed to a social construct.
Yeah.
And that's something you're not comfortable with.
No, that's a great point. No, I'm certainly not comfortable with it. I mean, I think I resign myself to saying, listen, it's still important today. Whether we like it or not, it makes a difference. And, the point I make in the book is, if you think about the National Security Administration, if you think about the CIA, when they're monitoring someone of Middle Eastern descent, you can bet they don't describe him as a white male, even though the law says that he's a white male. He's described it as a Middle Eastern male. And so my argument is this categorization is already being used in practice whenever it inures to the disadvantage of Middle Easterners. We might as well, in the census, give them a separate box. I say this reluctantly, so long as we're measuring race, because it'll allow, at the very least, measures of discrimination against Middle Easterners to be made. So an example I give is racial profiling. When one talks about, when they do studies about whether people are being racially profiled or not, it's very hard to tell if Middle Easterners are actually measuring the impact of racial profiling on them because they're classified as white.
I'll hazard a guess that they are being racially profiled.
Yeah, they probably are, but there's no measurement out there. One can measure, for African Americans, for example, and at least in studies, because at least we have data that classifies them separately. So I think that's one of the shortcomings, is the lack of counting people as Middle Eastern then results in a sort of invisibility. And as I comment in my book, the only thing worse than being being rendered into a statistic is not being rendered into a statistic in the modern world.
Yeah, you have an interesting example of having applied for a job and initially being turned down for that position and being told sort of under the table, the reason for this is because we can't take you because you're a white man.
Yeah, this is sort of the opening story I tell at the beginning of my book. It's sort of, you know, the instigation that led me to writing the book. You know, in my real life, I'd rather not deal with race issues at all. You know, I'm an attorney and law professor, and I focus on intellectual property and entertainment law. But I was on the job market a few years ago at a law school, and basically what happened was. You know, everything went well, but in the end of the day, a group of faculty voted against my candidacy. And as I was talking afterwards to one of the faculty members, he said, "Listen, John, don't take it personally. It had nothing to do with you. All the people who voted against you voted against you. You know, it had nothing to do with you." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Oh, it was just a race thing." And I said, "What do you mean, a race thing?" And immediately I thought, "Oh, they're discriminating against me because I'm a minority." And I said something to that effect, and he said, "No, John. The people who voted against you categorically refused to have another white man on the faculty. They want this position to go to a person of color." And to me, it was such a strange revelation in terms of into the, you know, degeneration of the politics of race, especially on university campuses. And it was especially ironic to me that it was a school where there was a large Middle Eastern population. They didn't have a single law professor or professor of Middle Eastern descent on the faculty. So I thought, my God, how ironic. And you know, the thing that came out of my mouth at that point when I said, when he said, "Well, you know, you're white," and I said, "Well, that's not what they call me at the airport."
Setting, John, blatant racism aside for a minute, what kinds of assumptions do people tend to make about you simply because you're of Iranian descent? Is that correct?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
What do people assume about you when they meet you simply because of your last name and your heritage?
Well, the last name actually creates some ambiguity. I mean, I'm partly Armenian descent also. So it's actually interesting. I get some very radical different perceptions based on whether they decide to focus on the first part of my last name, which says Tehran in it, or the last part of my last name, which has the IAN, which is often associated with Armenians. And it's interesting when they focus on the Iranian part, the images, of course, are of Islamic terrorism, jihad, misogyny, sort of barbarism. And, you know, everybody assumes, of course, I'm Muslim, which I'm not. Not that it matters, not that it should matter, but unfortunately, it does matter. You know, on the other hand, if they perceive me as Armenian, which happens occasionally, I get a very different set of traits assigned to me, and it's sort of much more pleasant, let's say, because Armenians are, you know, to the extent that people know about Armenians, you know, they're the first Christian nation, and so they're seen of as more white in a sense, even though basically Iranians and Armenians are from the same part of the world.
Was this something that your parents taught you to navigate when you were a kid?
In what sense?
Well, did they sort of give you hints about, you know, outside the house, be as white as you can? Or was it something that came up?
No,
your mother's European-American, right?
You know, what's that?
Your mother is European. Is that
no,
correct?
No, she's not. No, no.
Okay.
She's Persian, actually, as well.
Okay.
A couple of points on that. I mean, one of the funny things is my parents, they both moved to the United States when they were rather young. They were, I believe, both 17 when they came to the United States. And strangely enough, when I compare my upbringing to theirs, and we've talked about this a lot, they faced a lot less discrimination. Despite the fact that, you know, this was they grew up in an America sort of before the civil rights movement. But oddly enough, as a Middle Easterner, you were in many ways better off. You're off the radar, at least. And so in a sense, the experiences I had were ones they weren't entirely familiar with. Certainly they didn't know. I mean, they taught me to be proud of my background and all of that. So they weren't certainly like, oh, you know, cover and downplay and, you know. But I think undoubtedly what happens in the Middle Eastern community, and I talk about this in my book, is a tendency to downplay some of their traits and to project whiteness.
John Turanian is my guest. He's a professor at Chapman University School of Law. His new book is called Whitewashed, America's Invisible Middle Eastern Minority. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is law professor John Turanian. His new book is called Whitewashed, America's Invisible Middle Eastern Minority. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk for a minute, John, about media perceptions and how they sort of play into the perception of the race of people who are Middle Eastern. What do you see in movies and on TV today?
Well, you know, I dedicate a chapter of my book to this, and it's sort of near and dear to my heart, in part because of my work in the entertainment industry. But you know, it's very disappointing. You know, one argument I make is effectively we have this last minstrel show in terms of the portrait of Middle Eastern Americans, where it's a group where it is still acceptable to portray them in a very cookie-cutter way. The only times they appear on television or in movies are in very stereotypical roles. They're all portrayed as Islamic, and on top of that, as Islamic fundamentalists. The typical themes involve terrorism. And so people get a very one-sided view of Middle Easterners. And one of the arguments I make in my book is that this doesn't just ossify existing stereotypes, but it sort of expands them even. And I think it has an impact, because what it does is it creates fear. It creates fear of Middle Easterners that you see then played out. Incidents like the incident that happened a couple of weeks ago, where a family that was Arab was kicked off of a plane because they were asking about which were the safest seats.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. I'm amazed, John, at you talk about the show Beverly Hills 90210.
Yeah.
Which is, you make a point of saying that you only watched it for research purposes.
Yeah, all 200 episodes for research purposes only.
Although, given your age, I don't know. I have reason to doubt that. But
oh, don't call me out, Chris.
you make the point that there is not a single Persian character throughout the 10 years of the first episode, iteration of the show,
yep.
Even though 40% of the teenagers at the real West Beverly High School, yep, are Persian.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there is no real West Beverly. There is a Beverly Hills High School.
Okay.
Yeah, and as it turns out, 40% or so of the population there is Persian. There's a huge Persian-American community in Beverly Hills. Most of that, to change perceptions of Middle Easterners, I mean, most of that population is actually Persian-Jewish. Which to probably many Americans is a surprise. How can someone be Persian Jewish? Well, the fact is that Judaism is a religion, and there are many Persian Jews. But yes, remarkably, that show, despite its 10-year run, did not feature a single Persian character, which, you know, I say is amazing when you've got 40% of the population, the real Beverly Hills, essentially of Persian descent. And, you know, one of the comments I make is, well, you know, the storyline didn't call for it because there was no terrorism in the show. And that's unfortunate, because one of the things we need in entertainment media to sort of present a more fair and balanced portrait of all minorities or all groups is sort of showing them in regular life. And that was an opportunity. I mean, certainly regular life isn't, you know, living in Beverly Hills for everyone, but at the very least, showing them in a non-terroristic state, a non-Islamic jihadist state, would certainly contribute, and frankly, would show a more realistic portrait of Middle Eastern Americans.
Yeah, it is pretty extraordinary. I was thinking back on this, and I was thinking that the most normal Middle Eastern American character I've seen on television was Jamie Farr in MASH, and that was, 30 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. And again, pre-9/11, pre-Iranian hostage crisis. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, my understanding is there is a Persian American character on the new 90210. Have you seen it for research purposes?
For research purposes, yeah. I've actually only had the opportunity to watch one episode, so I can't really comment too much on it. I'm glad they made that change. I think it's an important one to make, and I'd like to see, you know, certainly more shows reflect Middle Easterners sort of as ordinary people like anybody else. A character can be Middle Eastern, and that can just be sort of a subpoint as part of their identity, and not necessarily the defining characteristic that then is associated with a host of other unpleasant traits.
John Turanian's book is called Whitewashed, America's Invisible Middle Eastern Minority. Let's speak to John in Fort Worth. Hi, John.
Hello. Hey, this is a great show, and thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I'm a police officer here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, And we do collect data whenever we make traffic stops on anyone. And one of the things that, one of the classifications actually for people of Middle Eastern descent is Asian. And we don't actually, they're either white, Hispanic, black, Asian, or other. So my guess is that sometimes they're being captured as other, and sometimes as Asian if parts of the country are in Asia, or white, actually. So I can see what your guest is saying about how there's not actual verifiable data, but part of that is because it's difficult. It's difficult to determine, you know, what their nationality is or their heritage, and we're not allowed to ask.
I was going to ask you that. So you just have to make an assumption, basically.
Right. You're not allowed to ask someone their race in this particular program when we capture the data. So unless that changes, then the officers that are collecting the actual data for the racial profiling really don't have any other choice. They just have to do the best they can.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling with that. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. What do you think about that, John, about the idea that you know, someone else is sort of applying a label, regardless of what one's race may be,
right,
whatever looks right?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of it, though. I mean, that's the way race has always been, in the sense that it, being a social construct, it's really something people evaluate, and they evaluate in lots of different contexts. It's not just the, you know, just looking specifically at your skin color. It's a whole host of other traits that they look at and evaluate, oftentimes in the blink of an eye, to categorize you. So I think, I mean, it's consistent with the reporting. You know, how do you define what white is? If I asked someone, you know, if I talked to Benjamin Franklin, he would have told me something very different about what white is. In fact, if you look at some of his old writings, he has this fantastic paragraph where he talks about how really Anglo-Saxons are the only white people on Earth. And then he specifically calls out the Swedes and says, if you look very carefully, you can see a very dark pallor to their skin. Which to us seems remarkable. How could a Swedish person not be white? But to Ben Franklin, it was not remarkable. It was just the way it was. And similarly, as you go through American history, you know, the Irish were not considered white. Italians certainly weren't considered white. In fact, in parts of the Old South, Italians were segregated with African Americans. And in parts of California, even if you go back as late as the 1950s, there were swimming pools that basically lumped Italians in with Hispanics and said that they couldn't swim in the pool with white people. So it's something that changes over time. Now you put an Italian in front of someone and they'll say, oh, that's a white person.
You make the point in the book that people of Middle Eastern heritage are considered white when they do conform to sort of social norms in this country, and Middle Eastern whenever anything goes wrong.
Yeah. I call it a process of selective racialization. I think this is it's sort of a social process that ends up, you know, anything bad gets associated with Middle Easternness, but there are plenty of Middle Easterners doing, you know, totally wonderful things in our country who we don't associate at all as Middle Easterners, which is very different than you know, other groups. For example, you know, you take Barack Obama, right? People, you know, in part associate him as our first African-American president, and there's a sense of pride in the African-American community. Well, you know, there's certainly Americans of Middle Eastern descent out there who are doing lots of very positive things. But when they do, we typically see them just as white. You know, I could list the name of Middle Eastern Americans, and many of them would be surprising to your audience that they were Middle Eastern Americans. So, for example, Steve Jobs of Apple, you know, has a Syrian background. Ralph Nader, a former presidential candidate, has a Lebanese background. Andre Agassi, the famous tennis player, is Persian Armenian. So these are individuals who are often just seen of as white. But the second something goes wrong and they do something transgressive, then we find out about their Middle Eastern background. So, you know, for example, you know, no one talks about Saddam Hussein as a white male or the Ayatollah Khomeini as a white male. No, they're both Middle Eastern.
Is it only sort of politically related problems that do that, though? Do you really think that if Steve Jobs were caught, you know, doing insider trading or something, would suddenly his Middle Eastern background be brought up?
I'm not sure that's necessarily the case, but let me give you another example. Zinedine Zidane, the French soccer player. Okay, he's of Algerian descent, but you know, sort of before his vicious headbutt during the World Cup a few years back, he was seen as nothing more than just a, you know, a French soccer player. People assumed he was French, of not just French nationality, but of French ethnicity. The second after his vicious headbutt on the Italian player, all of a sudden there were discussions about his Algerian descent. All of a sudden he went from being just a Frenchman to being an Algerian.
So there was a need to explain
what
happened.
And the subtext there was that there was something latently violent residing within him, and in part there was a subtext implicating that his Algerianness had something to do with it. I mean, it plays into the stereotype of the unrepentant sort of latent violence.
Do you think, John, that white European Americans consider it a compliment to you when they say, "Well, you're one of us. You're white like we are"?
I don't know. I haven't had those conversations, so I'm not sure. I certainly think we tend to associate whiteness as a good thing, and certainly even in sort of the post-racial world that some people say we live in, it still is associated. I'm not saying there's blatant racism as much anymore, but there's certainly subconscious racism, and all sorts of academic studies have backed this up. That still people subconsciously engage in racial judgments all the time, and there's certainly positivity associated with whiteness.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. John Turanian is my guest. His book is called Whitewashed: America's Invisible Middle Eastern Minority. Let's speak to Babak in Arlington. Hi, Babak.
Hi. I'm glad I'm on the show. And I actually had a comment to the police officer's question and response about the Asian versus, white when he's filling out the report. And I myself am going through like a graduate applications and find that when I'm coming to fill out the circle, am I Asian or am I Caucasian or white? And I actually recently found out the answer from a brown professor at university, and he defined it as Caucasian because, correct me if I'm wrong, the Caucasus Mountains were originally in are in the Persian area, and that they define that as Caucasian. Now, the problem I have with that is that I am a minority, especially in architecture, in Middle Eastern, and I'm an architecture student, and I'm classifying myself against every single Caucasian person, which is, comparing myself to every single white person. And I find that, not fair in college applications to show that I'm just another, just another white person applying for graduate school. And I think that should be addressed in college applications.
Have you thought about writing something in, Babak, or how do you right now you just check white and don't like it?
Well, I check. I don't mind it because I'm a Persian born. In America, and I'm proud of being American. I call myself American and Persian, but the way I identify myself is when they ask, what language do you speak? I say Farsi, and hopefully they'll get the response that, oh, he's Persian, he's not, just American, because I want to show that I am a minority also. My parents struggled to come to this country, and to give me a good education, and this country gave me a good education, so why not show that in my application, add that to, another plus. So,
thanks very much for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Can you relate to what Babak was talking about, John?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, obviously, it's funny he mentioned the story, the whole thing about Caucasian. Actually, I mean, he's right about that. The story about that is very fascinating, though. It basically goes back. The reason Caucasian became associated with the notion white was there was this German ethnologist, one of those guys who looks at skulls and determines race and all of that nonsense that's sort of been very widely discredited. But he had a skull collection when he was sitting around thinking about, race, and he created this classification of, the races of humankind. And his favorite skull in his collection was apparently that of a woman who had died near the Caucasus Mountains. And so when he decided, to label his favorite race, the ultimate race, he said that's the Caucasian race. So that's the origin of the term Caucasian, and, really has nothing to do with anything except this guy Blumenbach back in ancient, old Germany or Prussia liked the skull.
And this is where the idea came from, that they were three races on the planet. Is
exactly.
That right?
Yeah. Yep. It was basically different ethnologists, debated this for years, whether they're three, four, or five. That's where you get the classification, of Caucasian, and then the other racial types. But again, it very much a construct that's sort of changed over time and that has very, little bearing in reality.
Can you talk about this phenomenon that you called strategic covering that people engage in?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the this is the flip side, of on one hand you've got you have this classification of Middle Easterners as white, but also Middle Easterners by and large have fought very hard to be declared white, and in part because, as you can see in the past, legally that meant getting a whole series of legal bundles that you wouldn't be entitled to if you weren't white, and certainly even to today, one's status in society is affected by notions of race. And so one of the arguments I make is that Middle Easterners, they may do themselves an individual service by sort of downplaying their Middle Easternness and sort of playing off as just being another white person. But collectively, it sort of hurts the group because what it results in is sort of a lack of interest in taking sort of a group political awareness and talking about Middle Eastern American issues. So, I talk about Middle Eastern Americans, obviously, changing their first names. The women often dye their hair blonde or use blue contact lenses. And as a group that's sort of on the precipice of whiteness, they certainly can exploit that because people will pass. I mean, I'll give you a funny story. A friend of mine had a relative whose name was Mohammed, and he was going through an airport. Now, on his license and everything, all it says is Mo, M-O-E. So he gets, gets stopped, and as he's going through the airport, gets searched and all that stuff. And he's livid. He thinks it has to do with his race and everything. And he looks at the security guard and makes a comment about it. And the security guard says, "What are you talking about? It's not like your name's Mohammed." All the security guard saw was Mo and assumed he was a white guy.
Uh-huh.
Because, again, many Middle Eastern Americans, and sort of the image on TV is a little bit different than how Middle Easterners sort of look in person, but many can pass as white, but many also can pass as Asian. Many can pass as Hispanic. It just sort of depends. But I think what happens is certain subsects certainly take advantage of the fact of passing as sort of a European American. As opposed to a Middle Eastern American. And I can certainly understand why, because it makes life easier for them.
John Turanian is my guest. He's professor of law at Chapman University. His book is called Whitewashed, America's Invisible Middle Eastern Minority. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour with John Turanian. He is a professor of law at Chapman University. His new book is called Whitewashed, America's Invisible Middle Eastern Minority. We have an email here from Claudia who says, Sarah Shahi is one of two main characters on the NBC television show Life. She's from the Dallas area and is of Iranian descent. Her character was shown to be Middle Eastern in an episode last year and has used the language on the show in a few episodes. So at least there is some small representation on American TV. So good to know.
Yeah, no, it's true. There have been some other, Catherine Bell, who was in that old show, I think it was on ABC or CBS, called JAG. She's half Persian, and I remember she had some episodes that centered around her heritage. So there are some very limited strides being made, but, unfortunately on the big screen, more often than not, the portrait is one of sort of terrorism.
Mm-hmm. How did those perceptions and yet this great pride from within these communities, how do they sort of play each other out? I'm wondering about how this affects people's perceptions of themselves and of their heritage when they're living within a culture that may view them with suspicion.
I missed the last part.
That may view them with suspicion.
Well, I mean, you internalize it, certainly. I understand that the things I can get away with at an airport are less than other people's. I can't joke around about anything. There's something very serious. People look at me with suspicion, and so you internalize that. you know, I think you know, at times you tell yourself, okay, well, look, I'm taking one for the team. But at the same time, you know, in a world where we're supposed to have stopped discriminating on the basis of race, we still continue to do it in subtle ways. And I think what it does is it puts the group very much on the defensive, which is why you see covering behavior, which is why you see them downplay sometimes their ethnicity, although they're very proud, precisely because of that. And who can blame them? I mean, you know, I think what's happened legally in the last few years. One example is, you know, there's the famous Supreme Court case that came out last year, where the Supreme Court struck the constitutionality of affirmative action in high schools, and the famous line from the Chief Justice, Justice Roberts, was the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And that was a proclamation, sort of this idea that the government no longer discriminates on race, and we cannot, you know, engage in racial determinations, even when it's to help people who are minorities. But that very same year, you had a racial profiling case that went up to the federal courts, involving a passenger who looked Middle Eastern and was kicked off of a plane, much like the situation that just happened a year ago. And a jury found in his favor, went up to the federal appeals court. The federal appeals court threw out the entire verdict and basically stated that race or ethnic origin of a passenger may be relevant information and can be used to determine safety issues. And this is a case called Cercaria. Ironically, the gentleman who was kicked off the plane wasn't even Middle Eastern. He was Portuguese, but he was perceived of as Middle Eastern. So on one hand, you have the courts telling us, well, we can't use race to help minorities because that would be illegal. It would violate the Equal Protection Clause. At the same time, though, you have the courts still saying that we can use race when we're determining safety issues on a plane. It's like, well, can we consider race, yes or no? What's the rule? It seems like we're having it both ways, and unfortunately, Middle Eastern Americans are one of the groups that are suffering as a result, and you feel marginalized. I mean, you know, not to compare it to the example, not to say it was anything like the example of African Americans during the years of segregation and Jim Crow, but when one thinks about one of the reasons that segregation was finally struck as unconstitutional was the psychological injury it does to be treated as separate, to be put on the back of the bus. And in many ways on airplanes today, by having that specter of suspicion placed upon you at all times, a Middle Eastern American is riding in a position of inferiority and is made to feel it, and you internalize that. And it's an unfortunate situation because, you know, many Middle Eastern Americans are as American as anybody else. And to be treated as a second-class citizen is an incredibly humiliating and demeaning experience that no one should have to face.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Dolores in Dallas. Hi, Dolores.
Hi. I called in with a sidebar comment about the fact that in Dallas at one time, Hispanics were, by city ordinance, were considered white. But the last comment your guest made, I'd like to say that the Askins that Middle Easterners are looked at now is more akin to the way Japanese Americans were looked at World War II than it is like segregation of blacks.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. Thanks very much for your call, Dolores.
Thank you.
What do you think about that, John? Do you think that comparison works?
Well, certainly. I mean, the notion of you know, we're a nation at war right now against terrorism, and certainly in World War II, we were a nation at war with Japan. And, you know, I think it behooves us to remember some of the terrible consequences of that. One of the most regrettable decisions by the Supreme Court in their history was the case of Korematsu, where basically Japanese Americans were interned during World War II, and they challenged the internment, and the Supreme Court said, no, you know what, this is allowable practice, and it's a case that's been you know, regretted ever since. And you know, one of the really sad things post 9/11 was that in the immediate aftermath, people were calling for the rounding up of individuals of Middle Eastern descent. I mean, the statistics were remarkable in terms of the percentage of individuals who said that in fact we should round up Middle Eastern Americans just like we did the Japanese after World War II. It was sort of unfortunate to not heed the lesson of that regrettable moment.
What is the consequence of the fact that Americans now assume that Middle Easterners are a sort of seamless group without very often even trying to recognize the major social and cultural differences between one country in that region and another?
Well, I mean, I think it's dangerous from the point of view of our foreign policy because, you know, there are major issues of culture and there is a lot of diversity in the Middle East. I mean, one of the things I talk about in my book is, you know, there are plenty of Middle Eastern Christians, there are plenty of Middle Eastern Jews, there are plenty of Middle Eastern, you know, Baha'is and other religions. And most people from the American perspective view the Middle East as sort of an Islamic monolith. But I think also one of the problems that occurs is when we classify any group as a monolith, you sort of you tend to depersonalize them, and that makes it easier from a psychological point of view to demonize them. And as a result, you know, you think about what happened with the Japanese in World War II. The idea was, well, they're all Japanese. They all worship the emperor, and they're unrepentant worshipers of the emperor. They can never be Americanized. And as a result, that sort of dehumanization of Japanese Americans led to the rationalizations of internment. And I think we have to be very careful not to do that with any group, including Middle Eastern Americans today. But unfortunately, there is a tendency to think of them as a group. I mean, the idea, you know, one of the things I talk about in my book is when an act of terrorism is committed by someone who is a European American, we don't go, oh, man, European Americans, look at them. You know, no one's doing searches at schools targeting European Americans because they're more likely to go ballistic in a school, right? But people are, of course, saying, well, you know, Middle Eastern Americans, all the bombers in 9/11 were Middle Eastern, so that makes sense to give them greater scrutiny at the airports. Well, why are you assigning that particular trait to all Middle Easterners? It's the idea that when someone who's of, you know, a minority group does something wrong, that wrong is assigned to everyone in that group. Whereas, for example, the European American that does something transgressive, that person is seen as a radical outlier. We don't assign it to his or her race.
So if we were to add a category, say, to the census, specifically to include Middle Easterners as a separate subgroup, what do you think would change in this country?
Well, I mean, I think that's just a small step. I mean, it's a step I advocate, as I said, reluctantly. I think giving them a voice would help in the census, certainly for measuring things like racial profiling, but also giving them a political voice. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about a Middle Eastern American community is it's a tremendously well-educated community. It's socioeconomically sort of on average very well off, but it has almost no political voice. And in large part, that's because it's not measured. You know, people who are, you know, politicians know that there is an African American vote. They're cognizant of an Hispanic vote. They're cognizant of an Asian vote. But no one tries to appeal to a Middle Eastern vote because, in part, they don't know where the Middle Easterners are. They're lumped into the white category. So certainly, I think it might help from the point of view of giving a political voice, which in turn then will mean that policies that specifically target Middle Eastern Americans will be protested a little bit more heavily, and people will think twice about that simply because there'll be a voice saying, wait a second, we're American just like everybody else.
Is there reason to worry, given the current climate, of a potential backlash, so that admitting Middle Eastern ethnicity officially would then be an even greater liability than it might be today?
You know, I don't think so, because I think people are being assigned Middle Eastern racial status as it is. When I walk down the street or someone learns my name, they don't tell me, hey, you're a white man. They assign me the Middle Eastern status, or at least some of them do. So it's being done already, and I think it's better to sort of take the category and take it back effectively and begin to assign, you know, normality and normal traits to it instead of sort of letting it be imposed from without.
Very quickly, let's take a final call. This one's from Adam in Denton. Hi, Adam.
Hi. I called because I have similar problems to your guest today. I am a quarter Syrian and a quarter Polish of Jewish descent, and I have facial hair and a slightly darker complexion. And even though I do have a Polish last name, I do often get stereotyped as Muslim or just Middle Eastern. A lot of people in the workplace tend to joke about things like terrorism or assume other things about me that are related to just radical Islamics. And one thing that can be proactive and you lightly touched on this earlier, was every time that you have to fill out a form where you have to choose a race, check the box other and write in human, because we are all of the human race, and creating labels just leaves room for segregation.
Adam, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Not a bad idea to sort of make sure that we all know we're all ultimately the same.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I'd certainly support that. And in the long run, you know, I hope that we no longer have to have these boxes, because they've done nothing but a lot of bad over the years. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, in the short term, in order to you know, deal with the fact that there still is racism out there, we may have to have the boxes. But yeah, long term, there should be only one box, human.
Ultimately, John, who do you think has the power to correct the kinds of negative stereotypes that exist today about Middle Easterners? Does this have to come from within the community, and they have to sort of convince the broader American community of their value and their status, or will sort of the rest of America need to wake up on its own?
No, I mean, we all have the power. I mean, the fact is, you know, especially in the 21st century, when people are given the power of the internet and the ability to blog, and everybody has a voice with talk radio. I mean, you know, the fact that people can create videos on YouTube and have it seen around the world. I mean, we all have the power. We all have access to media. And, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to sort of do my small part in terms of getting the voice out there. But mine is just one voice of many, and it doesn't have to come from only Middle Eastern Americans. I think many aspects of the book can be related to by people of all minority groups, or even individuals who are not from a minority group, whatever that means. It's not just a story of Middle Eastern Americans. It's a human story, and it's an issue of just, you know, dealing with stereotypes, which I think everyone at certain points in their life have to deal with. So, in terms of addressing it, I think it's something that everyone can play a role in, and sort of about consciousness raising.
Were you surprised when you looked around and decided to write the book that there hadn't been one like this written before?
Yeah, I was flabbergasted, to be quite honest. There's almost nothing in the legal literature that deals with Middle Eastern Americans, which was absolutely shocking to me, which, again, you know, led me to take this big digression in terms of my normal scholarship and my normal sort of legal practice. I was very surprised, and I think, again, it suggests a somewhat of an invisibility, but also maybe a reticence on people to speak out. And I thought it was important to begin a dialogue.
Is it hard now to sort of let go of this, I suppose, after your book tour is complete, and get back to your regular work? Do you think this will remain a thread for you?
No, I certainly enjoy talking about this, and I enjoy my regular work doing entertainment and intellectual property law. It's all very interesting to me. So it's not hard. I mean, certainly this is something I'm sure I'll have a lifelong interest in, just because it's so personal. But at the same time, it's nice to do work that isn't as personal, because you're not as involved in it in some ways emotionally.
John Turanian is a professor of law at Chapman University. His new book is called Whitewashed, America's Invisible Middle Eastern Minority. John, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.